This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later on today's show, a big weekend is coming up for the Cincinnati streetcar system. We'll get a preview of that. First up, Cincinnati's unofficial mascot, the Flying Pig, is a reminder of the city's early days when the pork processing industry was such a huge part of the city's local life and economy, a time when Cincinnati was known as Porkopolis. There's a new exhibit opening this week at the Harriet Beecher Stowe House that explores this time in the city's history. Rethinking Porkopolis looks at just how much pigs and pork processing meant to the shaping and early growth of Cincinnati. Joining us to discuss the exhibit are Rethinking Porkopolis Project Director and University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of History, Rob Gioielli, Ohio Humanities Assistant Director, Dr. David Merkowitz, and President of Friends of Harriet Beecher Stowe House, Chris DeSimio. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And David, Rob, and Chris, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, a pleasure.
Rob, what led you to create this exhibit?
Well, this exhibit really comes from my research as an environmental historian, but also my teaching and working to try to connect with students in classes and help them understand things like the market revolution and urban environmental change, but also really the connections between different regions in the United States in the 19th century. I worked up a series of lectures and began doing some research that helped students connect to the history of Cincinnati. At UC, most of my students are from Cincinnati, and so they had a little bit of knowledge that I could connect to, and I began telling more and more elaborate stories about how we could travel from the really farms of Southwest Ohio to the pork processing plants of Cincinnati and take that story all the way down to the cotton plantations of the lower Mississippi River Valley and then around the world, as cotton planting was really the frontier of this story. And so the more I did this research and gave this lecture, I said, this is something that I think would be really good to tell to a broader audience, and then began thinking about it as a public history project, a museum exhibition.
What is environmental history, Rob, and why is it a good way to tell this particular story?
Environmental history is a relatively new and it's a broad field, but it looks at human nature relations over time. It looks how humans shape the natural world, how the natural world shapes the human world, and we think about things like diseases and storms, but also human ideas about the natural world. And I think it's a great tool for this because it focuses on those real material relationships, right? It focuses on how shaping an agriculture system for a pork economy really changed the environment of Southwest Ohio. It actually changed the physical makeup of pigs that you look to breed a pig for pork processing, how it changed the physical environment of Cincinnati. And then you can focus on those material connections to bring you specifically to other places.
Now, how big was the pork industry in Cincinnati during the 19th century?
It was huge. It's amazing when you look at some of the peak numbers in the late 1840s and early 1850s. Cincinnati was processing about 400,000 to 500,000 hogs a year. And those hogs average about 200 pounds apiece. And also remember that the pork processing season, the pork packing season, was only about four or five months or so. It was only from about November until about early February. And so for that short period of time, a tremendous amount of hogs came through the city.
So they were doing this when the weather and the temperatures are most conducive.
Exactly right. This is before we have advanced refrigeration. And so you have to do it in the colder part of the year. So you really begin around November 15th, and you really only last until about late February.
Yeah. Rob, why do we have flying pigs? Why do we celebrate matters porcine or porcine, depending on how you call it, instead of matters bovine here? Why the flying pig and not the flying cow?
Pork was fascinating because it was a tremendous tool for farmers to try to get their corn to market. And that was one of the reasons that pork becomes so popular is as a livestock, pork will eat anything. Pigs will eat anything.
Just about anything.
Right? They reproduce very quickly. They don't really take much tending or care.
Let them run loose.
Yeah. So originally they let them run loose. And then eventually when the farms become more advanced, they start putting them in pens. But it really becomes in some ways, a processing mechanism for all that heavy, bulky corn, which is hard to transport to market. You can turn it into a pig, and that pig can be transported on the hoof to Cincinnati. And also, pork is very popular because pork is very fatty, especially 19th century pork, makes it much easier to preserve with salt and smoking.
So how did it all get started? Any idea who came up with the first pig farm, the first slaughterhouse? Did Do we know that?
We don't have any origin moments, per se, in terms of one person, but we know it really began to boom in the 1820s. After the first major recession in the end of the 18-teens, the American economy begins to recover in the 1820s. The real turning point for Cincinnati is a discovery of new salt packing methods that allow you to create large barrels, 3, 4, 5, sometimes 600 pounds, giant hogsheads, which are easier to transport, and discovery of salt resources close by in Cincinnati in northern and western Kentucky.
Were the first pigs brought here from the east via riverboat, and was there a certain breed that thrived here or was the most popular?
Well, they didn't have breeds that we would call them today in the early frontier days, but they came with the East. They didn't come in any sort of boats. They would be brought with those early frontier settlers on the hoof. They would come with them. But that's really interesting because early pigs—
They called that droving, right, when they would actually walk the pigs in?
Exactly, yeah. Right. That was part of that. Those early pigs were what we would today call razorbacks. And so these would be semi-feral hogs because they would go and run in the wild over the course of the spring and summer and early fall to get their own food. It was very inexpensive to raise these pigs, and the farmers would bring them with them. And these were pigs that we would maybe call a wild boar today, and they had long snouts and tusks and bristly hair on their backs.
And not as much meat on them either.
Not nearly as much meat, and so they sacrificed the fact that they could raise themselves and feed themselves for the lack of meat, but they were primarily just for the farmers.
Yeah, they went by a number of different names, too, the razorback. They were called elm peelers, alligators, prairie rooters, and you might recognize this more modern term, land sharks.
Exactly.
Was this an area where a lot of pig breeding was being done, hog breeding?
Yes. Well, that's the thing, is that the early frontier farmers and settlers in the late 1700s and early 1800s, they bring those razorbacks. But then by the 18-teens and 1820s, farmers, especially in Warren County and Butler County, are beginning to custom breed hogs. And first they bring over specially bred hogs from England and Ireland, but then they start making their own breeds in the 1820s, 1830s, and 1840s. And really the Ohio River Valley, and especially the Miami River Valley, is the home of custom pig breeding in the United States.
Was Cincinnati the pork-producing capital of the United States? Were we the main hub?
Yes, we were the main hub, although other cities did have some pretty large pork-processing industry. Louisville is probably the number two by Cincinnati, but still was only about half the size.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And Rob, are there any names that people would recognize that made their fortunes in the hog industry?
Not in particular. Probably the name we recognize the most are the families that made their fortune off the byproduct industry. And that was because one of the reasons Cincinnati became the pork processing capital is because Cincinnati manufacturers and entrepreneurs realized early on that you could not only make meat out of these products, but you could take the fat, you could take the skins, you could take the bristles, and you could produce all sorts of other products from that. And so Cincinnati, because it was the home of the product and the byproduct industry, could pay higher prices for them. And so we recognize some of those early soap manufacturing families.
Such as Procter & Gamble or Jergens. And these are names that are still with us, which made their fortunes during pork packing's heyday.
Yeah.
David, let's have you tell us about the Ohio Humanities. What is that organization?
Yeah, Ohio Humanities, we are the state-based partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities. We've actually been around in Ohio since 1972. We are sort of most known as a grant maker, but we also sponsor things like Books by the Banks, which we provide with the Design Library, as well as put on a program called Ohio Chautauqua. And in a given year, we'll grant out about $300,000 for public humanities programs around the state.
Well, Rethinking Porkopolis, this was one of the first major grants of the Toward a Beautiful Ohio program. What attracted you to this particular exhibit? Why do you think that this was a good story to tell?
You know, so the way it works is that we sort of send out, we get applications from folks throughout the state, and then our board, who is made up of scholars and other public members of the state, you know, they really found this to tell a story that sort of hadn't been told. They thought it sort of told it in a new way, and I think they were also excited to see that the project was going to sort of bring some energy to a site, the Harriet Beecher Stowe House, that we have sort of followed over the years, but was sort of glad to see some fresh energy to. And so it also was a really good example of using sort of almost cutting-edge work of the academy and scholarship, and then taking it and using a topic that can really connect with the public.
And Chris, why did the Harriet Beecher Stowe House want to host this particular exhibit?
Well, because Harriet's experience with slavery, her Uncle Tom's Cabin, which changed the world. That book highlighted the horrors of slavery. And in Rob's work, he connects Cincinnati with New Orleans because a lot of the pork that was packed here was sent downriver to New Orleans, and it helped literally fuel the slave economy. In fact, Rob has done some work talking about how many calories per day a typical worker would expend out in the cotton fields and in the sugarcane fields. It was brutal work, and Harriet knew all about it because one of her younger brothers, Charles Beecher, had been in New Orleans, and he fed her all this information about the economy down there. Keep in mind, New Orleans first shows up in the U.S. Census, not in 1800, because it was still actually, then it was still owned not by France, but by Spain. And but it shows up in the 1810 census as the eighth largest city in the United States. By 1820, Cincinnati breaks the top 20 and is the 12th biggest. New Orleans is number six. By 1830, Cincinnati is number 10. New Orleans is the fifth biggest. These were huge cities. Cincinnati gains on New Orleans by the 1840 census. This is the time, of course, 1832 is when the Beecher family comes here. But Cincinnati was the seventh biggest city. New Orleans the fifth. And then by 1850, Cincinnati actually hops over, leapfrogs New Orleans, and is the fifth largest city. And a lot of that was built on the wealth of the pork packing industry. And, of course, the wealth of this city versus the commerce that was going on with the slave economy, which is what was fed by pork, is what was at the heart of this clash of conscience versus pocketbook. Harriet makes a point in her book, written after the Civil War, Men of Our Times, that roughly half of the commercial contracts written in Cincinnati prior to the Civil War used slaves as collateral, used human beings as collateral. And so think about that. So what was feeding and keeping that slave economy going? Well, it was stuff that was made right here in our own backyard. In fact, not so much our own backyard, but if you travel up I-71 out of downtown Cincinnati, just beyond the P&G World headquarters, and go in that valley between Mount Auburn and Mount Adams, that's where all the pork packing stuff was. So Harriet would have been familiar with it. The Harriet Beecher Stowe House really lends itself well. It's a smaller, intimate kind of setting. We're excited to have it here. We're very thrilled to be part of this.
And I'd like to say I've been very excited to work with the Harriet Beecher Stowe House because it's a small site. It does a great job of telling Harriet's story and her family's story. But what it also really does well is talk about the conflict within Cincinnati at the time, right? And that's one of the things we want to emphasize here is too often the Porkopolis story has been rightly celebrated but not put within the sort of full rough and tumble of the 19th century world. And I think the Harriet Beecher Stowe House does that very well, that being on that border between slavery and freedom, questions over who's going to be an American, who gets the benefit from the economy, are very important.
We will continue our conversation about rethinking Porkopolis. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Thank you to Tammy Lucas for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, joining us to discuss the new exhibit that opens at the Harriet Beecher Stowe House on Friday. Rethinking Porkopolis, Project Director and University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of History, Rob Gioielli, Ohio Humanities Assistant Director, David Merkowitz, and President of Friends of Harriet Beecher Stowe House, Chris DeSimio. You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. David, talk about the environmental humanities a little bit more as a field and their importance to exploring history.
Yeah, so the humanities, sort of in addition to sort of including history, which is my background, it also includes English and law and jurisprudence and anthropology and all sorts of other areas. And generally speaking, when we sort of use the word like environmental humanities, we're speaking of interdisciplinary attempts. So getting historians to talk to English folks. And it's, I would say, in the way that environmental history sort of gets its sort of energy coming out of the 1960s and Earth Day and that kind of stuff. The environmental humanities has a similar sort of path. It finds itself in studying things like Frankenstein and Mary Shelley, and sort of looks, you know, the history of the Romantic poets. And so it sort of brings in both sort of the story of, you know, pork production in Cincinnati, but then tries to sort of expand that conversation to include the impact of the Emerald Ash Borer in Cincinnati, and all the sort of context around urban forestry. So it sort of opens up the view to bring in a lot of different parts of culture.
And one of the things that we're finding, right, is that we talk about our current environmental challenges is that too often we focus on technological issues, right? And we focus on these type of things. And what we found is we have some technological answers and we have some scientific answers to these challenges and trying to find solutions. But many of the holdups we have are social and political and cultural in the present day. So one of the things environmental history specifically, but environmental humanities in general, is say, okay, how do we understand the social and the cultural relationships that people have with the environment? And how does that, you know, in the past, but also in the present day, because oftentimes it's those things that we need to overcome and how those shape those social relationships.
Rob, what was Cincinnati like at that time? Could a visitor come here and tell this was a big pork-producing town?
Depended on the time of year. And so one of the things we're going to try to tell in this exhibit is that people emphasize all the different quotes we have from different visitors and travelers, and they say, oh, I went into Cincinnati, and it's supposed to be this porkopolis, this pork-packing center, and there was all these pigs running through the street. And they emphasize that. But the truth is that if you were to go to any 19th-century city, you would see lots more animals, livestock, feral dogs, cats, goats throughout the city all the time. Frontier cities like Cincinnati often had city-tended flocks of pigs that they would use to help clear up the garbage. And so New York, Columbus, Chicago, Baltimore, you would see a lot more animals in the street. But Cincinnati would be unique during that pork processing season because the hogs came to Cincinnati on the hoof. And so from late November to early February, depending on the part of the city you were in and the time of day, you would just see droves and droves of pigs.
What kind of environmental impact are we talking here?
It also depended on the time of year. The primary one would be within Cincinnati's water system, and that was really when it was the slaughtering time of year. In those 4 months, most of the slaughterhouses were on the edge of the city, and this was common practice during those times to put all the dirty trades like packing and tanneries on the edge of a city. And so most of them were on, as Chris mentioned before, in that Deer Creek Valley, right over the present day, right underneath the present day I-71 corridor, right at the bottom of Mount Adams and Mount Auburn. And so the rivers there would really run with the blood of those animals, right?
One of them was called Bloody Run.
Yeah.
It was known as Bloody Run. These little creeks feeding into the Deer Creek. And then that would go over where the present-day Eggleston Avenue now is, which is the path of the canal. The canal was finished at least between Dayton and Cincinnati in 1828, and that also influenced the pork packing industry. But it would imagine the people who had to live down near Deer Creek as it entered into the Ohio River. It must have been a not very pleasant place to wake up in the morning and get a good whiff.
Yeah.
And if you ever, one of the great authors who talks about this, Lafcadio Hearn, and he's a sort of famous, spent some time as a journalist in Cincinnati in the 1860s and 70s, which is a little later. But Hearn has these descriptions of sort of the flop houses in that neck of the woods and the sort of going in and seeing the pig processing. And if you ever have a chance, I recommend taking a look at some of Hearn's writings in Cincinnati.
Yeah, that's great.
513-419-7100. And Larry joins the conversation now. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I just wanted to mention you already did allude to the fact that the other offspring of the pork industry, thanks to the pork industry, you have Procter & Gamble and what used to be Emery Industries. Of course, thanks to Emery, you have Marie Mock and what was Edgecliff and the Emery Auditorium and all those old historical spots around the area.
Yeah, good point.
But I go to work for Emory Industries back in 1966. And when I got there, there were, of course, they started as a candle maker, making candles from the stearic acid and fats and fatty acids and all that. And a lot of that equipment was still at the plant when I started there. And you mentioned the odors. Well, it was quite
fragrant
odor.
Odiferous.
Yeah. The color brings up a great point, which is that.
Thanks, Larry.
Procter & Gamble, but also other companies like Emory Oleochemical, which have their roots in Cincinnati in the 1840s and the 1850s. And what we forget is the chemical industry as we know it in the 19th century doesn't come from petrochemicals. Petrochemicals is a late 19th and early 20th century evolution, right, taking chemicals primarily from petroleum. But chemicals then, they came from organic products, and they came from different processed fats and different processed plant products. And, you know, Emory was one of the leaders in that in the mid-19th century.
Yeah. Let's talk with Don in Westside. Hi, Don.
Hello. Yes, I wanted to mention another factor that was important for the pork packing industry, and that is the German immigration. The German diet historically was pork-based, not beef-based. And, of course, there's a love of pork roast, pork shank, bratwurst, metwurst, and things like that. And many of the companies that were here, Kahn's, even today's Queen City Sausage, they had a German background. And so it kind of ties into the immigration and the cultural heritage of the region. It's something that could be mentioned also.
Yeah, one of the interesting stories I've found is that the early pork packers, when they were finished butchering all the hogs, they would actually take the spare ribs. They didn't know what to do with them, and they would actually just dump them in the Ohio River at the foot of the Deer Creek. And then by the time you start getting more and more German immigrants in the late 1840s and 1850s, they say, you're wasting this perfectly good cut of meat. And so you really get those German immigrants help bring more of an attention to these different cuts of meats, both for consumption in Cincinnati but also for export.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And here's Mary in Lawrenceburg. Hi, Mary.
Hey, good afternoon.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Go right ahead.
Well, my question is, when did they first discover that trichinosis would impact the pork industry? And how did they deal with that?
Wow, that is an interesting question. None of us are actually logged into a computer, so we can't rely. We can't go to Google right now to find that out. But trichinosis, was that something that clearly was it mentioned a lot, Rob? Did you find that in your research?
Didn't see much mention of trichinosis as a specific issue, but we know that they knew of the health problems of having spoiled pork, and that really defines the seasonality of the pork industry in Cincinnati. You can only butcher hogs in the cold part of the year, and they have to immediately be smoked or salted. So
they had a lot of curing processes,
yes,
to deal with certain things.
That's right. So I didn't see much in terms of the actual diagnosis of specific diseases there, but there was a lot of specific knowledge.
Yeah, Rob, once a pork, as you talk about in your exhibit and in some of your writings, it took 35 seconds from the time it hit the table. Once it was moved from the slaughterhouse to the packing plant,
yeah,
it took 35 seconds from the time it hit the table to the time it was disassembled. What kinds of chemicals, when they use salt, is it salt as we know it today? And then how long would it remain preserved and not refrigerated?
It would be what we might call pickling salt today, right? And so
okay.
It would be a coarser salt, and they would also smoke. They would also use a pickling brine. And so it wouldn't just be packed in salt. It would be actually pushed in a brine. And so it would actually be like we would see an actual pickled cucumber today.
Okay.
And it would last up to 6 months to a year, depending on how well it was packed. One of the interesting things is that Cincinnati's merchants, but in the early part of the 1800s, are looking to export this pork. But some of them are not packing it the best way possible. And so they actually push for the state to regulate it by the 18-teens. And some of the first food regulations come. The state of Ohio says, we're going to guarantee this was packed with a certain amount of salt. This is guaranteed to be fresh for a certain amount of time, or at least edible for a certain amount of time.
And how much more did it shape the distribution industry in Cincinnati?
In terms of
how did the pork industry shape that? Did it lead to a developing riverfront, more riverboats coming through the area? What was the ripple effect of all that?
They really work together, right? And one of the reasons that Cincinnati becomes that pork packing center, and if you look at other cities in the Ohio River Valley, early 1800s, they're all processing a similar amount of pigs. But it's Cincinnati's riverfront that helps it take the lead. It has that public landing, it has that public access, and then it has the canal, which provides another set of connections. And so they really work together in terms of Cincinnati having good connections. More pork processors come here. More pork processors here. You develop better transportation connections.
Yeah, because Rob points out in his work that droving or driving the hogs on the hoof, they would lose weight. And that's not good if you're trying to sell them by the pound. So once the canal was a really good thing because they would put them on first the canal boats. Imagine what that smelled like. And then railroad cars, too. So it was those ancillary transportation methods that really helped make hogs even more profitable.
But Cincinnati was really by the 1830s, you have that critical mass of the pork packers and then all the other byproduct industries which are using that animal. And so Cincinnati packers can just pay a lot more per pound for pigs. And so farmers are going to market their pigs here as much as possible.
They had a huge credit advantage too, didn't they?
They did. Yes, they had access to the banks because once you pack that pork, you're packing it in, say, December or January. You want to ship it out as soon as possible, but we have to remember the Ohio River would run very low in January and December and January and February would often freeze, and so it was hard to market it, and so it would just sit in those warehouses for 3, 4, 5, or 6 months. Well, that's capital that's just sitting there, and so having access to banking allows you to take out medium and longer-term loans that are a lot easier in Cincinnati.
Yeah. Let's talk with JR in Price Hill. Hi, JR.
Guys, I'm really enjoying your discussion here today.
Thank you.
The pork industry makes me think about Cincinnati's unique product of Geta, and we know where that came from. It's not, you don't find it in Germany itself. And I know it's an idea of stretching the meat with oatmeal, but any idea on that history?
I have to say I'll have to defer to some of my other colleagues who are food historians, but it doesn't specifically come from – there's no one corollary directly in Germany, but it definitely comes from taking German practices of taking oats and other grains and spices and stretching the meat out. So,
What eventually happens? I remember this huge pork-producing city. So what eventually happens in terms of that industry declining?
It really is the rise of Chicago, and Chicago has much better transportation connections, and it really is the railroad. And so once you have the rise of the railroad in the 1850s, railroads really begin to focus in on certain cities, and Chicago becomes the railroad capital of the West and the Midwest right around the time of the Civil War. Chicago gets some of the best contracts for producing provisions for the Union Army, and that really helps that city skyrocket past Cincinnati in the 1860s and 1870s and having access to all those Western markets. And Cincinnati doesn't fall immediately off the map. It's still processing a lot of hogs and some cattle in the 1870s and 1880s, but Chicago's just booming so much.
Yeah. Cyrus McCormick took his Reaper company from Cincinnati to Chicago because of the way the prairie was laid out and the way all that you could farm for miles, drive a tractor a horse-drawn implement for miles without having to turn it around because the land was so flat. Can't do that here very well.
Chris, can you tell us about the dates for the exhibit?
It opens this Friday, September 9th. We're open at the Harriet Beecher Stowe House from noon until 4. Admission's just $4. There's no extra charge for the exhibit, Porkopolis, and it runs through December 11th, and we're very thrilled to have it here.
And Rob, as far as there's a speaker series attached to this, tell us about that.
Yeah, in order to highlight some of the themes we have, we'll have a small speaker series, and we're really excited about our first speaker is Professor Syke Williams-Forson. She's a specialist in African-American foodways at the University of Maryland. She's going to be coming to town on October 6th, speaking at 6:30 p.m. at the Church of the Advent in Walnut Hills, and really highlighting this issue of the meaning of food within the African-American community, because a lot of the pork was consumed as rations by enslaved persons, but we want to tell a much richer story, and it takes really an expert like her to really engage us like that. So we're excited to have her here.
And David, Rob, and Chris, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Rethinking Porkopolis Project Director and University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of History, Rob Gioielli, Ohio Humanities Assistant Director, Dr. David Merkowitz, and President of Friends of Harriet Beecher Stowe House, Chris DeSimio. You can find a link to more information about Rethinking Porkopolis at WVXU.org. And coming up, we'll get a preview of Grand Opening Weekend for Cincinnati Streetcar System. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.